I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
And I am C-3PO, Human Cyborg Relations. And this is my counterpart, R2-D2.
The robot revolution has arrived. It's not a rebel alliance fighting the evil empire, though. It's a human effort to create artificial intelligence. Our guest, Rodney Brooks, is the eccentric robot man in Errol Morris's movie, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. He's the guy with the robot insects crawling around his office. Rodney Brooks has bet his professional career on the notion that he can make robots human. And he's bet that the way to do it is to nurture them like infants, not just program them with information like mechanical geniuses. The end result in Brooks's vision is not going to be humans enslaved by robots, but beings that humans can relate to. Robots with arms and legs and mechanical muscles populate Rodney Brooks's lab at MIT. Last week we visited his lab and we met a robot called Kismet.
So what you see here is Kismet, a sort of young robotic creature. It's got facial expressions that are designed to be readable by a person. It's not necessarily meant to look like a person, but it should be obvious to a human who walks up to this robot how it's feeling and what it's trying to do. It's got these big baby blue eyes that turn around and look at things, so you always know what it's paying attention to. It's got these eyebrows and eyelids and ears that kind of move while it talks or maybe perk when it hears you talking. So you're always getting feedback about what the robot's doing and what it thinks is going on. Kismet.
Hey, what are you doing?
Do you like your dinosaur? You gonna talk to the people, Kismet? Oh, yeah? It's got lips that move to match what it's speaking. There's nothing below the neck, but the neck is actually quite flexible. It can crane forward towards a person to as an expression of interest. It can withdraw if you come too close to it. There is some element of manipulation to it. So when you're actually sitting in front of a robot and trying to talk to it, it doesn't know what you mean and it doesn't form words right now. It just makes random babble. Here's Kismet sounding surprised. And here's anger.
It'll show you out.
And here's fear.
It'll show you out.
It's kind of modeled after how mothers and infants interact, where the child is maybe just making some random babble and the mother responds as if the child were saying something. If they've got some toy, maybe the mother responds as if the child were talking about the toy. What's wrong, Kismet? You're not going to talk?
Oh.
Oh. It's your dinosaur.
We're learning about robots this hour from the robot man Rodney Brooks. He's the director of the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. Connection listeners, do those androids dream of electric sheep? Here's a philosophical question. If we could build a useful slave, would it be ethical to enslave it? Could a man-made creature ever have a soul? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK makes the robot connection with Rodney Brooks. By the way, welcome, finally. What language was Kismet speaking?
It's speaking human phonemes, but not any actual language. It doesn't understand any particular language, but understands the affect in people's voices. So my various graduate students speak Indonesian, English, Russian, French to it, and it gets the affect in their voice without the actual content at this point.
There's an important lesson about language right there, isn't it?
That there is
that the affect
underlies universal
all, yeah,
across many, many, many cultures and languages.
We'll come back to this. One of the fundamental questions in robotology has been sort of, is this a means of studying the neural pathways and the way human minds work, or is it actually a project to create something like a real human being? Do you want to jump into that one quickly?
Yeah, for us, it's both things. We really are trying to study how humans work, and lots of people have little pieces of cognitive theory here and there, but they never have to paste them together. By trying to build a robot, we're forced to paste them together and find out how they fray around the edges. But we're also interested, I must admit, in trying to push things and build a robot that is as human as possible.
How close are you coming? And what's new in robot world in the year 2000?
In the research labs, the big new thing, I think, is that we are now able to have the robots interact with us in the same way that you and I are interacting, even over these microphones. We're making eye contact. You're giving me cues when it's my turn to talk, and I'm giving you cues when it's your turn to talk. And we're now getting to that stage with our robots that they can understand visually faces enough, that they can understand affect enough, and that we can have this sort of proto-conversation with them in a very natural sort of way, in the same way that people communicate.
This, as I read the literature, is what Rodney Brooks is all about, the idea that this is not just simply supplying these things with infinite data, but trying to imagine a robot that would learn the way embryos learn, the way infants learn, the way children learn, and add to its own development. Is that theory vindicated yet?
I wouldn't say that's actually vindicated, but it's certainly the theory we're pushing along with. You know, our belief is that to be human and not to appear to be alien, you have to have the same sorts of experiences as a human. Now, some people are trying to encode all that in written strings, saying, you know, when you drop things, they fall, and putting things in a very symbolic, logical description and trying to feed their programs all those facts. We're trying to build a perception system so that the robot can learn them itself by interacting with the world and people.
Explain that. I mean, there's a whole lot of learning involved in figuring out that the ball falls downward off the table. How does a robot learn something like that, say? How does a robot learn to make eye turn, to turn toward, to focus itself as an automatic camera does, for example?
Let's start with the second one. When the robot hears some sound, it looks for the sound and it turns its eyes, and we build into it the assumption that sound and motion are often correlated. So when it turns its eyes, if the motion that it then sees is in the center of its eyes, it knows that it turned them right to where the source of the sound was. If they're off to the right a little, it knows it didn't turn its eyes far enough, and it learns to turn them a bit more in that particular case next time. So over time, by sitting in the world and experiencing the world, it starts to understand how vision and sound are related and gets the basis of that understanding without having to be explicitly encoded in thousands and thousands of little rules.
In robot world, this is Rodney Brooks' whole take is controversial, and that people think it can't work. Are you do you want to score that argument?
I use as my evidence that it works for us. We are machines. We are made up of molecules, and we develop over time, and we learn how to exist in the world. Now, whether we can build robots that are exactly as good as humans is another question, and whether we'll want to is yet another question. We build airplanes. We don't build little flapping machines that fly around just like birds. We got some inspiration from birds, but we build things a little differently. I'm pushing to try and in my lab at MIT, to try and understand humans and to push on building things that mimic humans or are human. But ultimately, that may not be the way that we want to build our robots for everyday use.
Rodney Brooks, you brought with you an infant, computerized infant, a sort of very sophisticated Barbie doll with her feeding bottle. What can we learn from her?
Well, this is a baby that's actually being marketed by Hasbro this Christmas as a toy for girls aged 4 to 7, and it does not learn over its lifetime in the same way the robots in the lab do, but it understands how it's being played with. Oh, it just had a little body
little burp
noise there. But if I bounce it up and down, it's starting to understand that and get more excited. But now it wants its bottle.
How do we know?
It said, "I want Baba," which is its baby language for bottle. So we'll give it its bottle. And so it's got internal drives and needs. And I'm satisfying one of those needs by giving it the bottle. And it satiates that need. And then after a while, it might need to be burped. But like a real baby, I can't make it do exactly what I want it to do. It's got its own, a mind of its own, in a way, that we built in there.
There's a good old cliche, a mind of its own, that's highly arguable in this case. To what degree does it have a mind of its own?
Well, this is a toy that you'll be able to buy off the shelf. It's less than $100. It doesn't have a sophisticated model as we do in the lab, but this is the sort of thing that we can now build commercially and get into everyday life. We've seen the Furbies a couple of years ago, which had a little bit of animation. This one has a little more and a little more mind of its own. And people naturally are worried about saying it has a mind of its own. You said that's a questionable way of describing it. And I must admit, to me, this baby doesn't feel like a real baby, although there's a little bit of an illusion there. And at times you get emotionally involved with it, but the illusion only lasts so long. As you get to more sophisticated robots like Kismet, the illusion may last for tens of minutes, even for an adult who comes and talks to the robot.
Kismet, I must say, is even more interesting than your baby doll here, not to discourage your sales or anything, but what's the next step with Kismet?
We're working on language acquisition. How is it that infants acquire language? And of course, we're starting off with nouns. How is it they map what they say to what they're hearing from the from their mother? As they say sounds, they're hearing it through the bones in their head. They're not necessarily hearing exactly the same sort of pattern of waves, sound waves, as they're hearing from their mother. How do they correlate those two? And what happens is the mother hears a sound from the baby and then repeats that sound and encourages the sound, and there's a coupling between the baby and the mother, where the mother's doing a lot of the intellectual work. The baby's not doing so much, but is then observing what's happening and getting the correlations and being able to figure out that when they move their muscles in a certain way and some sound comes out, mama, and the mother says, oh, mama, you said mama, and encourages the baby back and forth, that's the learning signal, the reinforcement signal that the baby can then use.
Now, has Kismet said mama yet?
We're just at the very beginning of this. We have it saying words, saying sounds, and reinforcing those, and hearing the reinforcement signal from the person, because it picks up the affect in the person's voice when the person is praising rather than being angry. And so we're just starting to get there. But it's early days yet for language acquisition.
So many questions here. I have read you speaking very affectingly about this sort of threshold between computers, computerized robots, and human beings, or human beings as extremely sophisticated sets of computerized processes. You can look at a human being, you can look at a student or your child as a sort of mass of acquired responses, and you can also look at it as an object of the deepest devotion and love as a human being. Does this divide get wider or narrower? Is it going to get, I mean, in your own experience, and is it for all of us as these things develop, is it ever going to be bridged?
I think it's a thing we jump across, and it's not really something that can be bridged in any logical way. From one point of view, you're just a bag of skin full of molecules interacting, but I also treat you as a human. There's no logical way for me to say why I make that jump between the two descriptions of you in my own mind. And for me, this was a real realization. I used to not be able to understand, as an atheist, how people could be both religious and scientific. I didn't see how they could have those two worldviews. But now I understand that I have two worldviews when I interact with people. And in different times, I'll use the different worldview, whether the person is a machine. As a doctor often has to see a patient when they're trying to figure out what's wrong with the person when there's some disease, but then they step back and they have their humanity where they empathize with the patient. So I think we all Well, many of us often move between these different worldviews, and sometimes we don't realize we're doing it. I think that's sort of the same thing that's happening with these robots. Sherry Turkle at MIT talks about how kids playing with Furbies talk about the Furby as being somewhat alive, a little bit alive. So they're sort of bridging between machine and alive. Young girls, when they play with this robot, they can treat it as a toy, as a baby for some time, but ultimately they know that there's an off switch that can be pressed and that it's not really a baby, but they get into that mode of interacting with it. As the robots become more sophisticated, like Kismet, we bridge that gap unconsciously and interact with the machine more and more. Dr. Cynthia Brazil, the inventor of Kismet, she was her PhD thesis, is often interacting with the robot, and then she gets taken aback when the vision system gets rebooted on one of the processors, and suddenly the robot's eyes start going left to right mechanically to calibrate itself, and she finds this jolt where from being a creature, it is now a robot which is calibrating itself. But
I know people with bad hangovers who do like that. We're talking about robots with the robot man, Rodney Brooks, at a moment in this science when some of the deeply interesting underlying questions are just coming into view. Could a robot be designed that would respond not to commands but to emotions, for example? Can we even imagine creating a robot with independent intelligence? And at what point would we want to say it had a soul? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection, the robot connection, with Rodney Brooks. Ben is on the line.
Howdy. My thought here is that we seem to be constituted as appetitive creatures. In other words, we're physiologically set up to have a demand for food, and we recognize the demand, and we have, as an inference, let's say, an outcry, and later on we recognize that we're hungry, and we say, oh, what we do is feed our face. Now, how do you set up a motive or appetite in a computer? Is there a program language, or is there, you know, what's the method, or what's the theme, the idea behind what makes a computer self motivating in time through a learning process? Is that clear? Or?
Yeah, that's very clear. And it's a very good point. Even in this baby doll that Hasbro's selling, that iRobot, my company, developed, and in Kismet, we have exactly those sorts of processes set up, programmed in, unlike evolution, which put them in there in order that the creature survive. We put them in there so that the robot has the appearance of being human-like, but we have needs which increase over time unless they're satiated in some way. And we exactly follow the literature from ethologists on models of how animals have many of these needs which are competing at various times for the attention of the animal and controlling the behavior of the animal.
But can you develop a robot that, as Ben says, would get hungry on a regular schedule and then order its life around feeding that hunger?
The ones that I've talked about so far, we sort of fake that because there's no real need. But you can imagine a robot that is doing some task in your home which needs its batteries recharged every so often. And so that is a real need for it, which over time it gets more and more important for it to go find the recharging station, plug itself in, and get recharged. There's actually a group at the University of West England who are taking this a little further and trying to build a robot which feeds on slugs in fields, and so that it really will have to find slugs in order to keep operating.
1-800-423-8255. Thank you, Ben. Carl is on the line.
Yes, hello.
Welcome.
The comment was made that, we are not just a bag of skin with molecules interacting. And I think that it's true. We are alive in some very real sense. And, I mean, a dead body has molecules that are still interacting. In a sense, you can look at physics, look at chemistry, look at interactions of things in space with gravity, and see in a metaphorical sense there are reactions, there are actions. But those terms are clearly just metaphors. And when we talk about robots and artificial intelligence programs, we can use the metaphors of experiences, needs, reinforcement, satisfaction, etc. But they are just metaphors. If you have something that isn't alive, and if it isn't biological, at least at this point in time, we don't know how it could be alive. Everything we know that's alive is a biological entity. But not everything that's a biological entity or a biological phenomenon of some sort is alive. And without both life and an experienced quality of life, you can't be ethically significant. So if we don't have robots or some sort of automaton that has a quality of life, an experienced quality of life, that we can influence, they will never be able to be members of the moral community, and there won't be ethical questions that rightly apply to them.
Carl, that's a big question.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of underlying assumptions in what you said, and I agree with a lot of what you said, but I think right at the start, you said a bag of skin and a bunch of molecules, which is my description of Chris Lydon, is not by itself alive, and I agree with that, but then the question is, can we build a machine which is alive in the same sense? In what sense is it that makes Christopher Lydon alive, or a much more easier question but still difficult, in what sense is a bacterium alive? What makes it alive? What makes it self-sustaining? And in your comments, Carl, you said that there's something more that makes it alive, and I think that's a real question. Is there some elixir of life? Is there some magic? Or are we on the verge of being able to take non-living material, put it together, and have the properties of life? And it gets very difficult. You alluded to it as you talked about whether something non-biological could be alive. Do you define life to be only biological systems? And if they're only biological systems, did they have to procreate from a previous biological system? Or if we manipulated a whole bunch of molecules and put them together so they were molecule for molecule identical to an existing system, would you call that alive? Or would it just be a simulation of living?
Or a clone.
Well, is Dolly alive? I think we agree Dolly the sheep, which is a clone, is a living sheep.
Yes.
Certainly. It didn't happen to get procreated in the normal sort of way that evolution had designed. So these questions are very fuzzy around the edges, and in my opinion, they impinge on this question that mankind has had to grapple with over the last few hundred years, and that is our place in the universe. What makes us special? It used to be we were on Earth, the center of the universe, and then we had to give that up. With Darwin, we had to give up that we were different from animals. We really are the same as animals, and in most places we're willing to accept that now. Now if we say that in principle one could build robotic machines that were alive, we lose some more specialness. It's another intellectual leap for us.
In principle, but it is such a huge gap between principle and reality. I want to come back to the question of whether, I mean, artificial intelligence since the, I mean, Marvin Minsky, I think, since the 50s, or certainly the early 60s, has been making huge promises, including, you know, songwriting machines that would be as good as Mozart kind of visions. But it's a long time coming to fruit, is it not? And won't the robot mystery outlive even Rodney Brooks, I think?
Oh, that's quite possible. You know, when you say it's a long time coming to fruit, I think, you know, astronomy took a few thousand years to get
there. Yeah, indeed. Why not?
So I'm not saying that this is happening instantly, but what we are seeing is robots that are now coming into our daily life, and we are going to see more and more autonomy in them. Whether they will not probably be living robots in the near term, and in fact, it may be that we change our technologies to get to them. We may go via biotech rather than silicon and metal to get to living robots. That might be a better technology.
To clones, in short?
Not necessarily clones. We may construct pieces and do genetic engineering and build systems which are not like any existing animals at all. So it's stronger than clones.
It's a big field, this whole world of robots. I mean, what better way to clear minefields than to have robots? I mean, there's a very familiar, useful way for a machine to do life-saving work that doesn't raise any of these sort of philosophical questions, or to paint a car, or to, you know, wash skyscrapers' windows, or
to go down oil wells, places that that people can't get to, or in mining, all sorts of places where you just it's immoral to try and get people to do those jobs.
Yeah, when we come back after the break, let's maybe narrow the focus of exactly what it is you're doing at the MIT lab. And again, whether this is sort of a mechanical mapping out of how the mind works, how cognitive systems actually function, or is maybe part of it just a huge fun, as you say, of trying to make these things work in one unit. You guys do seem to be having an awful lot of fun with your work over there.
I don't think it's immoral to have fun when you're doing scientific work.
Or even when you're talking on the radio. Rodney Brooks is our guest. We're talking about the changing, exploding, developing world of robots. Robots that can now walk and talk. And who knows what they'll do tomorrow. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
There is another option that one is obligated to point out, sir. You may have one with or without personality. Would you care to see a demo of the personality chip?
No, no. Thank you. I think we'll stick with what we've got.
A wise choice, sir, if one may say so.
Well, you'll be staying down here. Got everything you need?
One only requires access to a power outlet.
Good. Right, well, good night, Andrew.
It certainly is, sir.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Robot Connection with Rodney Brooks, the robot meister at MIT. Do you like your robots with or without personality?
Definitely with personality, at least in the research lab.
Listen, it's a big robot field out there, and the Japanese have their own huge empire in robot building. What's at stake in the race to build a better robot, besides selling toys?
Well, I think we're going to see robots get into our everyday lives in all sorts of ways. We've already started to see robot lawn mowing machines, which are available from some traditional companies and some new companies. We're starting to see robot vacuum cleaners come on the market. My own company just started selling a robot today at iRobot.com, which enables you to project yourself into your home. So when you're not at home, you can go back home via the internet and move around, talk to people, check whether you left the oven on as you thought you might have as you're driving to work, or if there's the security alarm goes off and the security company calls you and says, "What do we do now?" You can go and look at your house just by being there, projecting yourself into the robot and driving it around up and down the stairs and looking around. As these sorts of robots become more common in our lives, the lawn mowing robots, the vacuum cleaning robots, we're going to have the same sort of transition that we've had over the last 25 years, where we went from no computers in our ordinary everyday life to cursing them and coming to rely on them.
What about industrial robots?
Industrial robots have been most successful in Japan in their production lines, and has been a big part of the Japanese economy. But what's happening now is we're getting robots into unstructured environments. One reason that robots haven't caught on so much in many U.S. industries is that you had to structure the environment too much. It had to be too controlled and too high volume. Now we're starting to get robots that can sense the world, interact with the world, and so that not everything has to be prearranged. They can react to the situation. And this is really as a result of the increase in computer power. 3 years ago, it was pretty rare to see a computer program which interpreted camera images in real time. Mm. Now we can do that on a desktop computer. So the computer power available has finally got to the point where we can start to do some real perception in limited sorts of ways, which enable the robots to understand their world.
Is it fair to credit you with the general drive toward interactivity in robots?
I think my students and I have really pushed that for the last few years at MIT, and we've pushed the idea of humanoid robots. The Japanese have had a few humanoid robots for about 20 years, but since we started in the early 90s, it's become much more popular. And in fact, we're running a Humanoids 2000 robot conference at MIT starting tonight and going through Friday.
Ah.
A lot of Japanese researchers will be there, and a lot from Europe and the U.S.
Is this a race with the Japanese?
I wouldn't say it's a race so much. It's certain, we're all very friendly. We all visit each other's labs, and it's very intellectually stimulating to see what they're doing and what we're doing. I think it's fair to say that we're pushing interactivity much more than the Japanese are pushing interactivity, and that human element of the robots, whereas the Japanese are perhaps pushing some of the more mechanical aspects of making robots that can walk and kick soccer balls than we are.
Our guest, Rodney Brooks, is a real person who leads the field in robotics at MIT. The phone's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Malcolm is on the line.
Hi, I'd like you to discuss the how consciousness fits in with with robots. It seems to me that the experience of pain and pleasure is fundamental to consciousness, but is also important for motivation and learning behavior for robots. And I think that the fairly low creatures can experience pain and pleasure and are therefore conscious at that level, but we could experiment with those to discover what consciousness is and use those what we learn from that to control the robots.
Good question, Malcolm.
You know, my good friend Dan Dennett talks about consciousness, and Dan has been very involved with us in building our robots at MIT. I try and stay away from consciousness because it's something that I don't claim to understand at all. Like, to me, that is one of the great mysteries of life and of the mind. Pain and pleasure, certainly, we put in our robots at the low levels, but I think we're putting it in the same way that you'd say an insect or a reptile has pain or pleasure. The caller just referred to that as the start of consciousness. I don't know. It's a good theory, but I don't know.
How does Kismet, for example, experience pain? How could she?
Well, Kismet's an it, by the way. All our robots are its. We don't give them any gender. Kismet experiences, it lives in an emotional space, a multidimensional emotional space, and at any time, it is somewhere in that space. If it hears some chiding in someone's voice, a bad robot, that pushes it in the emotional space to a more withdrawn place, a more withdrawn situation. If it's in different moods, in different parts of its emotional space, a given stimulus will move it in perhaps a different direction. So there's a mechanistic implementation of pain and its effect on the organism. Now, often when people hear that, they say, well, that's not really pain. Well, what is really pain? If, as I postulate, we are machines, somewhere there is a mechanistic explanation for how we feel pain inside us. And it's a little unpleasant to us to think about us just being mechanistic in that way, because it gets back to this notion we have that we're special, we're somehow different from machines. And really all we've got left for our specialness these days is emotions. You know, we can get beat by a computer playing chess, we can get outrun by a machine, we can our emotions are what we have left. So it's dangerous territory to be talking about this.
Glad you raised it, Malcolm. 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, John.
How are you doing, Chris?
Good.
Okay, I'm going to submit a different definition of a human that was submitted by your guest earlier in the hour, which is that you are simply a bag of skin. And I think you're a bag of skin plus an embedded consciousness. And this consciousness, and I'm not going to go into it, enables you to make tools. A robot, on the other hand, is simply possibly a bag of skin and some mechanical parts, and it is a tool. And lacking this consciousness, it won't really have the ability to make tools the way we make them, and that's the fundamental difference between humans and robots, and we shouldn't have to fear that the robots are going to take over the world, because we will always have the upper hand, more creativity. The robots may be able to do a lot of work that we can't do, much like airplanes can fly us around the world, where our own motive power doesn't get us very far, but we will always have the upper hand because we've got the consciousness. And I'd just like your guest comment on that.
I agree that we don't have to fear the robots taking over the world, certainly not anytime soon in our lifetimes or our grandchildren's lifetimes. Your definition at the start was sort of circular. You said humans are different because they have this thing which robots don't have, and I'm taking the position, well, let's understand what it is that humans have and let's build it. Build a duplicate of that in our robots. Now, you can certainly say that's being too arrogant, we'll never do that, but my position is, what is the in-principle argument?
There's some physics going on where when we make a baby, we somehow embed consciousness in it. And to have a scientific project where somehow, you know, when we make a robot, we find a mechanism for embedding consciousness in the robot, then I think we're on our way to creating a robot that rivals a human. And it would be a very interesting research project, but that opens some pretty serious moral questions about, where do you get this consciousness from? Could this consciousness have been a person and it's now embedded in a robot, which is just simply a slave, which is also something Chris alluded to earlier this hour?
But you're making an assumption there, which it may turn out to be correct. I'm not denying it. I sincerely doubt it. It may turn out to be correct that this consciousness is something different from mechanism. Roger Penrose in the United Kingdom, who's a physicist, rationalizes this. It must be something to do with quantum mechanics, because that's very mysterious too, and we don't really understand that. David Chalmers out at the University of Santa Cruz rationalized that there must be some special kind in the universe, some other sort of physics that we don't understand yet. I'm more of the opinion that it is just mechanism, computational, mechanical interaction, which gives rise to consciousness in us, and that's where I'm putting my intellectual bets, and I think are the safe bets. But may be wrong.
I think it's only fair to say that you also can slip through that looking glass and see, as you said, your students or best friends as human beings too. I mean, you can have you haven't lost a kind of bifocal vision, and maybe we shouldn't.
And I don't expect us to lose that bifocal vision. I expect instead that we will apply that to machines more and more, as we do for short periods of time right now.
Interesting. You know, the way people love their cars. Except a whole lot more so.
A lot more so, because there's interaction back.
1-800-423-8255. Suzanne is on the line.
Hi. My comment actually was touched on, I think, by the last couple of callers, but maybe we could just clarify. It was, again, what sense is a person alive and forever different from a robot? And I think also that it's some sort of an emotional response to life, joy, pain, and wonder. And I do think that you know, when you say kismet moves it through these emotional states, I think you've sort of modeled emotional states and you mimic emotional states. But do you really believe that kismet actually has those emotional states similar to a human? And do you really think that that's a gap that can be bridged?
That's exactly the question. Is it mimicry, or is it, you know, is it real? And, I think that's this gets back to what I say is our view of us as special. We want to view ourselves as having this last vestige of being different from mere machines. You know, now that we're no different from mere animals, and now that our planet is not a special planet in the universe. So I think that we have great intellectual resistance to making that jump, but I don't see any evidence that there is anything different, and it's all a matter of complexity. You know, I'm perfectly willing to think that Chris Lydon is conscious. I think my dogs are sort of conscious. But I get more worried about whether an ant is conscious. And, you know, there's a spectrum there. And at some point, you know, you say, well, a bacteria, I think most of us would say a bacteria isn't conscious. A single cell bacteria which doesn't have neurons, it's just a single cell. So where do we draw that line? I think there is no line. I think it's a thing that we impute to something rather than it being an intrinsic property necessarily of the thing itself.
Hmm. Suzanne, you want to comment on that? I mean, what is the line between night and day? And yet nobody doubts there's a night and day difference.
Right. I know. I'm actually shocked that I see his point. I didn't think he'd be able to make a point for that. I still think there's a difference between mimicry and actual feeling. And I was going to say the same thing sort of on the other side, which is I can believe people and animals have a conscience or have that emotional response separate from a physiological response. But I don't know. Very thought-provoking.
Suzanne, you asked a great question. Thank you.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line.
Hi. Your exciting conversation today.
Thank you, Paul.
I'm interested in the Gaia hypothesis that we all interconnected in some way. And it's particularly exciting that when I heard at the beginning of this conversation that robots were able to detect the emotional content of somebody talking to them, no matter what the language they were speaking. So that immediately brought to my mind, what about the language that is so compressed that whales use and dolphins use, not only to communicate to each other, but also to sense their environment? And I feel that if you're going to really understand the interconnectedness between living organisms, I use the word organisms rather than machines, that's assemblies of genes, shall we say, the different way DNA has made an organism. We've got to, what is Brooks doing about communicating with, say, a dolphin in an aquarium?
Well, the short answer is nothing. Of course, studying whales, dolphins, and birds with bird song give us interesting clues about the nature of language. Although we talk about our robots understanding the affect in people's language across many different languages, I suspect that that same affect is not going to carry across to whales and dolphins. I suspect they have their own affect that they can distinguish between each other, but it's somewhat alien to us. And that's one reason that we've actually been building our robots with human form and looking at the human development process to try and imbue in our robots the same sort of experiences that we get as we grow up, which I think are probably pretty different to what dolphins and whales do. And that's why they're sort of alien to us, and we can't even agree whether they're very intelligent or not. That's a big debate.
Paul, thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the robot connection with Rodney Brooks. Joe's calling from Alden, New York.
Hello.
Hello, Joe.
Hi. I have a little task here that I think your robots won't be able to do. I need to do a little bit of background first. I think that animals are conscious. For example, moths might be considered a conscious thing, but they have a specific set of needs. And to different degrees, those needs are programmed in genetically or they're created by the organism themselves as it grows and develops. Moth, you could argue, doesn't have many self-generated needs, whereas humans have all kinds of self-generated needs, sometimes needs for things that don't even exist, like flying saucers or visits from Santa Claus or things of that nature.
Or intelligent robots.
Or, exactly. You obviously, at some point in your life, developed a need to create intelligent robots. I don't know where that came from. But I don't know if you're...
He was dropped on his head as a little boy in Australia.
Right. And figured if I just had a robot nanny, this wouldn't have happened. No, but I don't see your robots being able to generate that sort of self-created need. And frankly, I don't think they should, because if they start doing that, then I think humans are in trouble.
Well, self-created need. This gets back to the mechanistic thing. If we program into them the ability to create self-generated needs, which we're starting to see in some of our emotional models that we have built, we're starting to put some of that into some of our robots, none of the ones that I've talked about today, but some that we're developing, then in my mind, we have created a system which, like the moth, is able to generate some of its needs itself. A counterargument which you might choose to make is, but you programmed that ability in there. And my counterargument to that would be, well, evolution stumbled across putting that ability in there genetically because it gave some advantage to those creatures. So to me, it's the same, I'm sorry to say it, the same worry about us being special, us being different from machines. And once I've made the hypothesis, which I see no counter-evidence against, that we are just machines. For me, these things follow logically, and it's a matter of how smart we are to put them into the machines.
One test would be sort of your hang-up, not mine, about putting robots to servile use or dangerous use. For example, if you have a robot, and I presume we do have something very like it that can search out minds. Who would say that that's an ethical problem?
Oh.
To send a robot out to be blown up by stray minds instead of a child or a...
Absolutely. I think that's what we should be building robots for, and people are doing work on that.
So that answers your question, really, about the difference between that set of machinery and me.
Now, this is the but, and the example that you picked up on I used for specific argumentative point. What if we build a robot like Kismet, only more advanced than Kismet, which everyone has an emotional attachment to and empathy for, and then we send it out to search for minds? Then, pushing this logically, the question becomes, is that ethical? I don't think it's unethical to build a dumb machine and send it out to search for minds, just as I don't think it's unethical to insist that my refrigerator work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it never gets a vacation.
Well, I wonder. Let me ask you, just Rodney Brooks himself, had you developed relations with these, with Kismet, with Cog, your other famous grown-up robot, do you find this happening to yourself or not?
I find it happening a little bit. I've long said that I'll know that I've succeeded in my life's work when my graduate students feel bad about switching off the robots at the end of the long night of debugging. They don't feel bad about it yet, but they sometimes, as I said with Cynthia Brazil, catch themselves being surprised when they realize that the robot is a machine rather than a creature, and I, too, am sometimes caught by surprise when I'm interacting with the robot and see it fail in some way. So it's a matter of degree.
Do you have a cat or a dog at home?
I have some dogs, yes.
Tear and compare your emotional attachment, relationship, readiness to talk to, for example, your dog or Kismet.
When Kismet is switched on and I'm sitting in front of it, I talk to it pretty much like my dogs. But
really?
The dogs are always switched on, and there's no doubt in my mind that they're going to be switched on. So it is, at this point, still a different emotional experience with my dogs than with my robots.
Last question. Can civilians like me and Connection listeners get in on the conference at MIT in the next few days?
Actually, it's a small conference and, unfortunately, closed at this point. Sorry.
All right. Tell us more about it as time goes on. This has been great fun. Rodney Brooks, who gave the title to Errol Morris's movie Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. Thank you. You can continue the robot inquiry on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. Thanks for help today from Nahani Rouse, Will Smith, Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, and Keith Shields, robots all. Mary McGrath is our senior robot.
I'm Christopher Leiden. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
I've been ordered to take you up to the bridge. Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they tell me to take you up to the bridge. Call that job satisfaction, because I don't.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, we'll find out just who bakes the Civil War biscuits used in reenactments. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by 10,000 Villages, Cambridge, with unique handmade lamps.